Welcome back to the Hashtag Health Podcast. This is the second part in our two-part series on managing the surgical wait times in Ontario. In the first part of our series, we talked with Dr. Urbach about some of the solutions that have been implemented in parts of Ontario for certain procedures, including team-based models of care and a central referral system for common procedures, where the goal is to have the next available surgeon see the next patient in line. Today, we welcome back our guest, Dr. David Urbach, to continue our discussion on how we can implement these solutions in Ontario and the challenges that may be encountered with reorganizing our system to deliver surgical care. All right, Dr. Urbach, welcome back. In the last episode, we talked about how team-based models of care and the centralized referral system might allow for patients to see the next available surgeon to perform a certain procedure. So I'm wondering, from the patient side of things, where sometimes patients may not meet their surgeons until like the day of or moment before the surgery, I get that that can be a bit concerning. Is there any evidence, whether it's anecdotal or through any studies that have been done, that shows where patients lie on this? Are they accepting of this model?
Yeah, so it's mostly anecdotal. So these programs work great. Patients are highly accepting. So with our bariatric surgery program, there's not an issue and there's no way around it. But I'll give you other anecdotal data. People often go, Canadians who are very concerned about their care, if they have wealth and they have access, they may hop on a plane and go to the Mayo Clinic, or they may go to Memorial Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson or some, you know, because I get these questions like, well, should I go to Mayo? Should I go to Cleveland Clinic or something? And often they do, and they'll go and they'll may or may not have a serious problem. They may or may not end up having a surgery. They will not meet their surgeon until the moment before their surgery. Often it's like a fellow who's like part of one of these programs. But what the reason they do that is because the brand of those institutions and the reputation is a signifier to people that this is really good quality of care. Like, you're going to get care at least better than anyone can do in Canada, like the best care in the world. So they're not trusting an individual. They're trusting a system of care. But that's what a brand means. Like, a brand is a signifier for some phenomenon, because people can't measure quality themselves. So what we're used to doing is, like, a family doctor will tell a patient, oh, you know, you should see Dr. Urbach. He's the best for hernia surgery, and he's great, and he's friendly, and whatever. The family doctor has never met me. The family doctor has no idea how I repair hernias. Like, family doctors will refer patients to a number of different general surgeons, usually actually a small number, but they don't even know the universe. They just happen to send them to the surgeons that they've sent them before. They know their facts, and they've seen their patients before. Are they good? Are they bad? They haven't a clue. Luckily, most surgical care in Ontario and across Canada is actually of very high quality. There's very little bad care out there because there tends to be a lot of oversight in hospital care. There's, you know, operating rooms are lots of people. They're very transparent. There's nurses, anesthetists, there's assistants. It's hard to hide major quality problems. So quality is generally very good. But that's just the stories that referring physicians tell to their patients to reassure them, because we don't have any other signifiers or brand identifiers in our health system. Even if people think, oh, I'm going to London Health Science Center, that's like a great institution, but you know, you may end up seeing some surgeon in an office that's not even in the hospital. It might be in a medical building a few blocks away, or maybe it's in the hospital, but that surgeon isn't necessarily integrated into the processes of the hospital when they're still just managing their practice. You just refer to a person who will see you and provide their opinion, et cetera. So the anecdotal evidence that having some pre-existing long relationship with a surgeon is such that people ignore that all the time when they pick up and go to the US for care, that's almost always unnecessary. Very frequently not even as good as the care, or as appropriate as the care they would get in Canada, but they do it because that's what they trust. But this happens all the time. Like, forget the surgeon. If you have to have your hernia repaired, the provider with the biggest determinant on major aspects of your health is your anesthesiologist. You've never met them before. You have no pre-existing relationship. you're putting your life in their hands. You get referred for an interventional radiology procedure. Nobody cares about looking up who the interventional radiologist is. They don't follow you longitudinally. Emergency departments, transplant surgeons, the most complicated operations I've ever seen in my life are like redo lung transplants, liver transplants. These are complicated operations that require high skill and expertise. Most of the time, if you're a patient who has this operation, you may never see your surgeon, period, because you may have not even have been, in a state of consciousness when you kind of deteriorated to the point that you need this operation. But even if you do, it's the surgeon on call. Emergency general, when I'm emergency general surgery, the biggest operations I do are like emergency colectomies, major operations. There's no pre-existing longitudinal relationship. There's no opportunity to choose your surgeon. And there's no basis upon which that a person would have any rational information or reliable information to make that sort of choice. So the way I see it is, I think it's overstated the extent to which the personal individual is actually relevant for surgeons. I think surgical practice is really just a form of professional practice. I think we do it a disservice when we personalize it so much and wrap it with the identity of the person who is the surgeon, because really we ought to be able to function in a care environment just by doing our professional roles and being another member on the team. The downside of personalizing care, having specific surgeon, knowing a surgeon, is that systematically discriminates against certain types of people. So we know that women surgeons tend to get fewer referrals, less poorer types of referrals and patients, different. There's a big pay disparity among women surgeons and men surgeons based on the types of patients who are referred to them. So it discriminates. Basically, referral opportunities, when you can identify a surgeon, and generally, as I've said, are not like very precise information on their skills. It relates to their gender, their age, the color of their skin, the language, whether they have an accent. I mean, these are the types of factors by which somebody might identify an individual. And so it may give opportunities to make discretionary choices. Often they, in practice, those look like the discriminatory choices, which again is not something that I think a system should be participating in. So I think it's healthier as well if we depersonalize the surgeon, and again, the surgeon becomes just another member of the team, fulfilling a professional role in a way, to the best of their abilities, providing good quality of care, just like everyone else does, like the anesthesiologist does, like the radiologist does, like all the nurses do, like everyone else in the healthcare system, except often it seems the surgeon.
Yeah, I think that's really strong evidence that goes to support how the shared care models and centralized referral systems can have all these benefits to patients, even though they may not be able to meet their surgeons until right before their surgery. I am curious, though, we already spoke of the Ontario Bariatric Network, but I'm wondering, what are some other examples of either shared care models or centralized referral systems that are already being implemented here in Ontario?
Yeah, so there's a few examples here and there. So a lot of cardiac surgery in Ontario follows this model. It doesn't work 100% because there are workarounds, but generally the Core Health, that used to be the Cardiac Care Network in Ontario, used to kind of be a central intake mechanism. I mentioned the Ottawa Hospital. Most cancer surgery, general surgery, is an entirely team-based care. Taking a step back from shared care, but single entry, in principle, notionally, it exists in a variety of different places. So there are hip and knee rapid access clinics, which are called RACs, across Ontario, and technically every single patient who needs a hip or a knee replacement is actually not supposed to be referred to an orthopedic surgeon. They're supposed to be referred to a RAC. They're supposed to be assessed by an advanced practice physiotherapist in a RAC to determine, using standardized instruments, whether they need surgery or not. And then only if they need surgery, they're supposed to be referred to an orthopedic surgeon. So technically in Ontario, we have single entry for hip and knee replacements. In practice, we don't, because very few patients actually get referred to the RACs. They're basically still just referred directly, because no one ever said to the family doctor, you're not allowed to, there's no mechanism. They just refer to an orthopedic surgeon based on their historical practice. And what the orthopedic surgeon will then do is send the patient afterwards, if they think they need surgery, to the RAC just to kind of normalize. So they'll be assessed by the advanced practice physiotherapist. So a system that was supposed to be 95% single entry and 5% workaround has become, you know, 98% workaround and maybe 2% single entry, but the intent is there. And then there's other programs here and there that work shared care as a necessity. So people may not think about this, but obstetric care, you know, you may have an obstetrician who follows you for the time of your pregnancy. Most, the way obstetrics works in most hospitals is at the time of delivery, you're being cared for by a team that is almost certainly not your historical obstetrician. So it's just the person on call who will manage your labor and delivery. If you need a cesarean section, they'll be the person doing your cesarean section. If you need an instrumented delivery, they'll do your instrumented delivery. It's almost entirely a team-based model of care, because that, you know, at 24 hours, the old team shifts out, the new team shifts in. If you're still in labor, you'll be taken over by the new team. So like all those things in my mind are also shared models of care, because they, again, de-emphasize the personality of the care providers. You know, it doesn't matter that your obstetrician was Dr. Smith and now it's Dr. Jones or something like that. It's that you have an obstetrician who's providing care for you. So it looks mostly like that. And there are experiments in Kitchener-Waterloo. There's a single entry program for cataract surgery. And these models that are scattered around the province, including Northern Ontario. So there's nothing terribly as systematic as the program I participate in for the Ontario Bariatric Network, but I think that's an ideal and the type of program that I think we should have for other common procedures. So we should actually have an enforced kind of single entry model where all the patients who actually need a hip or knee replacement do, like, so we actually figure out a way to make sure they actually go through these routes that we're funding, you know, they're all taxpayer funded facilities, but, you know, there's ways that you could, you know, put in rules to make sure that patients actually go through them, or to build similar types of single entry models for common procedures like hernia surgery, like cataract surgery, like other types of surgery.
Do you think there's any systematic plan from policymakers or government to implement these centralized systems or team-based models across Canada, or at least across Ontario? Is there any push there?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So there's push everywhere. The problem is, and it relates, so every healthcare system is kind of complicated and problematic, and they all evolved in certain ways. No one, if you set out today to design a health system, you would do it totally differently, but no one can do that. So whether it's in Canada, the US or Europe, Australia, like, we just inherit systems that evolve to be the way they are, and they perform exactly as expected if you were to have designed a system. But they're generally poorly designed systems because they weren't designed. You know, in Ontario, and I know Ontario better than the other provinces, the health agency that's supposed to oversee and address these issues is called Ontario Health, or OH. They're funded by the Ministry of Health in Ontario, and they have they have a lot of resources. They get a lot of money from the ministry. They have a lot of really good people working, and they're trying to figure out and implement these types of programs. They're not doing it very aggressively because they don't want to interfere with physician practice. So there's a real reluctance, and this is a bit of a theme, the way healthcare is structured in Canada, is that, you know, hospitals, by and large, operate under legislation, the Ontario Hospitals Act. They have a certain framework, but physicians are quite separate from hospitals. And it's been very difficult to actually meaningfully change the way physician practice happens in the province. Physicians have a large degree of power and autonomy and independence based on legislation, based on precedent, based on legal precedents, with sort of actions around physician practice. So it's very complicated to manage a system where kind of everybody's in charge and nobody's in charge, but that's sort of the way the health system works. So so government and government agencies have been kind of reluctant to pressure or to use effective levers around sort of rules or funding mechanisms or other types of, you know, active measures that would try and move things this direction. What I can tell you is primary care physicians, referring physicians, are desperate for single entry models. They do not want to do what they're currently doing, which is exhausting for them, and it's burning them out, which is trying to get someone to see their patient and trying to manage expectations of their patient. And they don't want to be kingmakers, and they don't want to figure out who should be successful surgeons or who are not. Like, they don't, they if you had 1-800-hernia, they would go to 1-800-hernia. So family doctors are desperate for it. Health system leaders really want it because this is the biggest problem with affecting long wait times and variation. It's lack of coordination across the system. So government wants it. The health agencies want it. Referring physicians want it. What do patients want? Patients may not totally know what they want. If you ask patients, they'll want everything. They'll say, I want to choose my doctor because I want to choose the best doctor. I want to be able to choose them on some basis of like good information. So give me reliable quality information, like all these sorts of things. It's very hard to figure out exactly what patients want, but I can tell you what's very acceptable to patients is single entry models where they're confident they're getting a high quality of care. So for sure, patients are willing to work with these models, and especially if they've got reassurance that they're getting excellent care. What patients really want is access. When they have a problem, they want to see a qualified specialist about it. And if they need surgery, they want to get that surgery. They generally want those things as quickly as possible. So basically every stakeholder really wants these models, except one. Who's resistant? The surgeon. So because I often do this when I talk about this, because and surgeons tell me, well, why hasn't this happened? Why hasn't this happened? And I say, okay, well, let's do a thought experiment. Let's all close our eyes for a second. And let's all believe for a moment that we actually believe that everything I've said to you is true, that this will improve access, that patients are happy with it, that you can work with your colleagues, that you can share, that it's, let's just pretend that that's all true. And let's pretend that that's what we want. We actually want to have a shared list. Like, there's six orthopedic surgeons in this hospital. You all do knee and hip replacements. You all have your own fax machine. You all take your own patients. Let's pretend that all six of you actually wanted to share and were willing to just take patients next available off a list. Okay, close your eyes. Let's say this is what you want to do in your hospital. How long would it take you to put that to implement that? Right? Like basically to turn six fax machines with six numbers into one fax machine. So that would take, if I said it would take a weekend, I'm exaggerating. So there's no impediment. And people think, oh, what about tech? What about investment? What about, like I said, like it's not that expensive to throw out most of your fax machines. This isn't really a complicated tech. You don't really need to build the Uber. You can even start just by creating a situation where in the same hospital, surgeons are not competing with their partners for patients. Just share a list, and everyone's got, and there's plenty of patients. One thing about Ontario, there's lots of people who need care. None of us are gonna, no surgeon is gonna be starved out of the market because they all of a sudden they're gonna lose their practice because they're sharing off a common list. So I wish I could tell you something otherwise, but that's basically the barrier. Because if surgeons actually just wanted to put this into place, it would be in place. And all the surgeons who wanted to do this have done it. And the surgeons who have done it will never go back. So it's not like the people in the Ontario Bariatric Network are saying, no, I've had enough of this. I'm gonna set up my own shop and do my own bariatric surgery and try. Like, that doesn't exist. The surgeons in Ottawa, the hepatobiliary surgeons and the colorectal surgeons who do big cancer operations would never ever go back to a model where they because they understand how it works better for everybody.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like we're at a crossroads here where we have examples where this is working and there's patients and doctors who are happy with the centralized system that they're practicing in. And then there's just not uptake all across the board. What do you think we need to get there to get everyone on board and to implement this more consistently throughout Ontario? Is it that we need more data, or what else could it be?
I'm not sure we need more data, but we're working on collecting more data. I think so. I'm trying to be as persuasive as I can through advocacy. But with anything in life, if you want to achieve some sort of behavior change, that you can use carrots or you can use sticks. Carrots are always more attractive. But there are rules that the province could put in place, like the way that they fund procedures. A lot of surgical procedures are funded at the same rate regardless of the model of care that's used. So just going back to the knee replacement model, a hospital in Ontario receives the same funding. The surgeons are paid separately. In Ontario, we have OHIP. You know, we're all, you know, most of doctors are fee for service, and they get, but just setting aside how doctors are paid, because my assumption is they'll continue to get paid in the same way. But hospitals are paid the same amount of dollars for an episode of care, no matter how that patient arrives to the hospital. So if you have a knee replacement in a hospital and you're having it because you were referred directly to your surgeon who's brought you to your hospital, the hospital gets, you know, $8,500 for that episode of care. Or if the patient was referred through a RAC, a rapid access center, which is could be tracked, the hospital gets the exact same amount of dollars. If Ontario Health decided, we're really interested, we want all the patients to actually flow through these RACs to get to see next available, why don't we set up a differential payment to hospitals? So we'll pay the hospitals a full fee if the patient goes through a RAC and was seen like through the central intake model. And we'll take 30% off. So we'll pay the hospital, instead of $8,500, they'll get $6,000 for the episode of care. So if Ontario Health did that, it would take maybe a week before the leadership teams in these hospitals figured out, like, oh my God, we're losing thousands. We can't provide this surgery anymore. It's going to cost us too much money. And the first thing they're going to do is feed up to their manager, to their director, to their VP to say, we got a problem. Like, you know, Ontario Health is crazy, but they're only funding us at this lower rate. But the first thing the CEO is going to say, okay, well, tell your surgeons, they can only operate on patients who get referred to the RACs. And then the surgeons, when they get direct referrals, are going to say, love to see this patient. You're a very special family doctor. I've had this great relationship with you, but the government's crazy. You got to send your patient to single entry. And the family doctor will say, there's single entry. But yeah, we're supposed to have been doing this for the past 6 years. So there's ways to do it. I mean, there's ways you can implement rules or funding rules or that would influence behavior. But I think the bottom line is that, if surgeons are actually persuaded that this is in their interest and they can coordinate, then it would happen organically, because it's really not difficult. It's not expensive. And there's no massive IT infrastructure that people think you need, at least in a local level. If you want to coordinate the entire province, you might need a little bit more data infrastructure. But you could at least start within hospitals.
Yeah, I agree. Incentivizing this model could be a great way to get surgeons and more hospitals on board with this type of model. I want to switch gears here a little bit and ask you if there are any other models for delivering or organizing surgical care that are being used in other regions or other countries that you think Canada or Ontario can draw influence from.
Yeah, but it's a very difficult situation, because no health system is perfect. And in fact, I will say no health system on planet Earth is really all that good. And that's just a problem with healthcare. It's not because, the fundamental problem is that modern healthcare that people expect to be able to get is very expensive. You know, per capita in Canada, I forget the exact numbers. I think it's like $6,000-$7,000. Per capita, it's the amount of money that nobody's willing, not nobody, but most people don't want to spend through tax revenues or through cash payments or insurance premiums or any way, but they still want that level of care. Like if they have a trauma, they want $150,000 worth of care, including critical care, et cetera, to save their life. If they want cancer, they want the full course of cancer treatment, could run $100,000, $200,000. Drugs are very expensive. Everyone expects this, but no one wants to pay for it. But when you have expensive healthcare with high demand, you want it quickly and you want high quality. So you want good, cheap, and fast for a service that's expensive. You can't do that. So you have to you have to put in some barriers in some way. And in the U.S., it looks different from Canada, U.K., Australia. So every system is a bit of a mess. And in the surveys, like if you go and survey every single country, even the highest performing country on the comparative Commonwealth surveys, like the highest you get with like the system doesn't need to be rebuilt is like maybe 60% satisfaction with the system. So it's not like any country is like 90, 95% satisfied. It peaks at 60. A few years ago before COVID, it peaked at 60. So maybe you're lucky if like half the people thinks the healthcare system is not a disaster in any country on planet Earth. So we're not going to solve this. There's no solution. It's trade-offs. And so the things we can learn are the good and the bad in different areas, but you can't translate context as well, because there's no country that's exactly like Canada. So we're very unique in the terms of the fact that there's really no private private for-profit delivery sector that competes directly with the public sector. That doesn't exist anywhere else in the world except for some marginal countries. People talk about Cuba, North Korea, but like in the OECD countries, the developed cooperation Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, like it's very unique what Canada has, and it's likely related to values and political imperatives. Whether that's going to change, it's hard to know. There's clearly a lot of political interest right now. It's sort of eroding a lot of the fabric of sort of a single payer health system, but it makes it difficult to apply lessons from other countries directly in Canada, but we can definitely learn a lot from other places, including what not to do.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to contextualize our discussions on healthcare delivery solutions to specific systems because each one is so unique in how it delivers care. I know recently, as you've been saying, there's been a push towards a privatized or adding the second tier of healthcare delivery. But the ideas we discussed today and the solutions you detail in your research for improving Canadian healthcare are through the lens of preserving our publicly funded universal healthcare system. So just to end off our show today, I was wondering if you can touch on the benefits of preserving and strengthening our universal healthcare system in comparison to, say, introducing a private tier to our system.
Right. Well, because it's less expensive. So private care is always more expensive to the extent that we already are constraining costs. It won't address long wait times. And if any system, and you've mentioned international comparisons, greater introduction of private care just increases waits further in the public system when there's a parallel system. And I don't think it's consistent with our values and the goals of equity and population orientation and who we're trying to serve. So I think there are some providers who believe it's in their interest, and a lot of people are very entrepreneurial and business-minded, and you can create new products and services and generate new markets and niches, but it's not going to target the biggest crises and threats to the health system, which are these very long waits that people perceive, as well as these other issues.
All right, Dr. Urbach, that's all I have for you today. Thank you very much for joining us today. I really enjoyed the discussion.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. All the best.
That concludes our two-part series on addressing surgical wait times here in Ontario. While there are many possible solutions being proposed and implemented here in Ontario and across the globe to deliver surgical care in a more timely manner, we hope that having these discussions about how our healthcare system can improve leads to real changes that give patients access to high-quality surgical care in a more timely manner. Thank you to our guest, Dr. David Urbach, for joining us today, and thank you for listening to the Hashtag Health Podcast. To be the first to hear about our new episodes, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Hashtag Health Podcast.